You Landed on the Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Philip Marinello, joined here by my lifelong friend and co-host, Trevor Aiken.
Howdy, man.
How's it going, man?
Good to be here. Good to be here on a Monday.
It's a night of old friends here tonight, yes, on The Substance.
Indeed, indeed. Very excited for it.
The Substance here at the podcast, we are a Christian variety show, and every other week now, we talk for about an hour or so about things related to Christianity, culture, and the arts. Sometimes we're here solo, or others, like tonight, we have great guests. Previous guests who aren't Jesse Eubanks, welcome back here to the show, include folks like Justin Gibney, Jamar Tisby, Pastor John O, Caitlin Schess, and Propaganda. Be sure to go back and check those out in the library if you're newer to the show here. Then towards the end of the show here, we're going to be sharing some shout-outs of things we've been finding edifying and enjoyable. So that's us, the show. You know the deal here, Jesse. Welcome back, man.
Hey, I am so glad to be here. I do have I want to ask a real quick question right out of the gate. A moment ago, you said...
Flip the screen. You misinterview us.
You ask us questions.
I love it when that happens. That's genuinely my favorite.
Hey, you know what? You guys are doing fine, but honestly, let me just host. Why don't you guys just take a seat?
You and love thy neighborhood. Substance edition.
Mr. Christian NPR over here. take the wheel. Wow.
Okay, you described The Substance as a variety show. Is there an expectation that I will be doing animal tricks or
WC Fields act over there, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, we thought we were going to put you on bass or something.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, we have like a musical number.
Okay. Yeah. All bass solos for the whole hour.
And then you have your opening monologue ready, right?
I do.
Oh, okay. Great.
I do. It's not very funny, but I do have it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a dramatic monologue.
Taking care of. Yeah.
Awesome. This is a tragic monologue.
That's right. I know. That's right.
No, it's interesting you bring that up. It's kind of hard to describe what The Substance is sometimes. I tell guests what you described us as kind of like the bizarro Theo Bros. It's like
not my favorite thing for Trevor to say first about the show.
It makes more sense. Sorry about
that,
guys.
It makes more sense when you say it. You know, when I say it, people look at us askance. Like,
well, yeah, they don't know what bizarro means, and they hear Theo Bro. It's that's the worst when Trevor says that.
Yeah. So.
Like we have like three or four different formats of shows. So it's not every episode's an interview or every episode's a book review or every episode's a movie review or every episode's just a pop culture or a theological or biblical topic.
It's
like
different.
We have different formats of show.
Love it. I love it.
And variety show is the technical term, but most people don't know what a variety show is, or they think of like something silly, but
I say
just check the library.
Awesome. I love it. Okay. Now you guys can, I'll pass the reins back to you. You're now allowed to conduct the show.
Yeah.
No, you're well, good. So Jess, go ahead, Trev. You hit it.
Yeah. I just wanted to say for listeners who may be new to the show, Jesse's been on before, but if you don't know him already,
you should
go check out like the Top Christian Podcast because Love Thy Neighborhood's up there.
Regularly in the Ineacast and shouted out more than once here.
If you listen to podcasts and you haven't listened to Love Thy Neighborhood, what are you doing? Cue it up next, right after this episode.
Just stop listening right now to
Jesse.
Make sure you hit our Patreon on the way out and go for Love Thy Neighborhood right now.
We don't have that.
I'm like the mega church here to steal members from the small church. That's basically what's going on right now.
Hey,
They should listen. There's enough time to go around. They can listen to Love Thy Neighborhood too. It's amazing. And the Ineacast as well. And now, author, this is your first book, I believe. I mean, you've done workbooks and all sorts of great writing things, resources before for the church, but
you've created a lot of content. You've written a lot, but this is your first book.
Here it is. How We Relate, Understanding God, Yourself, and Others Through the Enneagram.
Trevor, did you get a legit final copy or did you also get an advanced copy?
I have a legit advanced copy. To me, more legit. Oh, I don't know.
Hilarious. He said legit advanced and like I just got whiplash. That's hilarious.
Every page is page zero.
So I was going to ask because I've been working from the advanced reader copy. So I don't know the answer to this. first book, what is how does the dedication read, and how did you come to that decision?
Oh yeah, great question. Okay, so let me read it. So first off, as soon as I read it, I think it will probably be obvious why I chose what I chose. So here's the dedication of my book. For Lindsay, my beautiful, thank you for showing me how to love and be loved, and for imagining the first doodles that eventually created this book. So, nice. So the backstory is, yeah, maybe like 8 years ago, my wife and I were preparing to teach an Enneagram workshop together, and she works in the public school system, and she said, you know, this is a lot of spoken content with really big ideas. There's a whole lot of words on the screen. And she goes, we really should figure out a way to try to communicate these complicated ideas in a more simple fashion. So she literally like got out a piece of paper and she doodled two different things that actually, if you open the book now, they're in there. The first one was the deadly sin is a flower and the raindrops, yes, like the way that they're nurtured.
So good.
How does each type nurture their deadly sin? And then the second one was the idol, which came from Jerome Wagner's work. He's got this really great blog post. It's literally just a blog post where he talks about the idols of each type, which I was inspired by. So that makes I do a version of that in this book as well. Yeah. So the book has like, I don't know, like 100 doodles in it.
I love the doodles. I was going to ask you about them too when I was reading through today, because I'm like, these are really helpful, and that's really awesome how it came out of some of that original work that Lindsay did.
Yeah.
Hey man, teachers, they're great. Pay them better.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Say that.
So I'm curious, what has been the initial reaction? I know Enneagram is kind of a controversial topic in some circles, or some people are kind of making it a thing to kind of be outraged about. How's the response been on your end of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's been like beautiful and frustrating all at
once. Are you keeping away from the Amazon review section? Are you?
No, that's what a wise man would do. That is not what I am doing. No, it's been like really, truly wonderful. I mean, I've gotten feedback from a lot of folks. I mean, here's the thing. When I wrote this book, the intention was I want to write the Enneagram book that I wish that I had when I first came across the Enneagram. So there was a lot of like really great content out there that was very clear about the psychological theories of the Enneagram. And there was also some content out there that was like factoring in Christian faith or books that were about Jesus as it relates to the Enneagram. But like nothing was like kind of pulling all of it together into one spot. And so all I have to say is that some people, I think when they read the book, they get that. I think the other thing that I'm really encouraged by in terms of response is if you read a lot of Enneagram stuff, you got to have a pretty high educational acumen to kind of track with some of it. It's like, it's pretty highbrow kind of stuff. And I wrote this with the intention of, I really want this to be a book that the psychologically informed, highly educated person and the blue collar worker both can appreciate it. And I've been really encouraged because I've received a lot of feedback from both of those camps. And so that part's awesome. It was not my favorite thing that Jackie O' Perry had her conviction the timing she did.
Like, right around release day, right?
Like 2 weeks or so before the book comes out. And I'm just going, well, that's unfortunate. Because, you know, of course, you know, I love JHP's ministry. I mean, our ministry was involved when she came here to Louisville. You know, there's so much about the work she does that I do appreciate. But the reality is this, is that I have a very small following. She's got almost 1 million people that pay attention to her. And so when she says something, the tidal wave is just going to be very sizable. And it really, really did. You know, for people listening, you're going, what did she say? So her remark was that she was concerned that the Enneagram is demonic. And she cited concerns about some of the primary architects that helped create it. And then went on to say that she had to apologize to God for her involvement with it. And that created a lot of anxiety in people. So people that were already anti-Enneagram went a little further with that. And folks that had been fine with it suddenly are now hearing one of their favorite Bible teachers use the word demonic to describe it. And so that's definitely showing up as well. So like if you go online, you know, you're going to find a 5-star review and a 1-star review, and they're both going to be kind of representative of those perspectives. Yeah. So in all seriousness, if you do pick up the book, if you're listening to this and you pick it up and you appreciate it, it really would mean a lot to me if for you to go online and to review it, because I am like sort of in the same way people will like go out and blast Marvel movies if they feel like there's some secret agenda, like, you know,
yeah,
you know, it's sort of that kind of stuff. People feel like the Lord is calling them to go online to leave anti Enneagram reviews against the book to protect people. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Oof. I'm kind of bummed that that happened, but at the same time, not really surprised. I was going to ask you about the church's relationship to the Enneagram over the last year and a half, because I feel like there really was a wave of Enneagram resources. To your credit, I think you've achieved exactly the goal you were talking about, because I told Philip, this is the book that I wish existed 2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
When, you know, everybody was talking about the Enneagram.
When COVID hit, I feel like we spent a lot of time studying the Enneagram because we had time. Like, I got the wisdom of the Enneagram.
You had to filter out a lot of New Age mysticism. You had to filter out some light on sin Christianity in some cases too. Like, you had to filter some of those things out, right? And just rock with people in grace and empathy for a while to understand that they're the real resource that was there, right?
Yeah.
We live in a time where things that require nuance like that end up becoming polarizing, which is tough. And so, you know, when what ended up happening in the, at least my personal circle, was the Enneagram kind of became this thing where people had had encounters with folks and thought it was highbrow or arrogant that people thought that they, you know, knew themselves in this way because of this tool, and that they didn't get. And so it was easy to make fun of it. If they weren't outright like skeptical about like the origins of it side or think it was evil, you know, they were just like, eh, I don't know. Like, I have the Bible. I'm a simple person. That's enough.
Yeah.
And then you had the rest of us who were like actually benefited from the Enneagram in our own lives, our work lives, and our marriages, who like kind of have this like secret network now where it's like, feels like it's gone underground. Is that also your assessment of the Enneagram's relationship to the church now? And how does it fit into all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think, I mean, listen, like, even like my pastor endorsed this. Like, if you turn on the, if you look at the back of the final copy of the book, it says, you know, there's an endorsement from Dr. Jamal Williams. Like, that's my pastor. Yeah. And even Jamal said, you know, people were coming up to him after Jack Gilperry's comments and saying, our church has to disassociate itself completely 100% from the Enneagram. Wow. So like,
that's kind of wild.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And let me say this too. Let me just address this, and I'm going to do this in like 45 seconds. And if you're listening to this and you're like, I don't know what the heck this guy's talking about, you can go Google it, but I don't want to belabor this, cause we'll Love That Neighborhood is going to do a whole episode on some of this soon. Like, and we're going to go really in depth on some of this stuff and look at like historical records and actual quotes. But the short version of this is this. A lot of the key architects that have developed the Enneagram over the last 100 years are not Christians. And they had very eccentric religious beliefs that are absolutely incompatible with Christian faith.
Yeah.
But they also pulled a lot of content that ultimately came out of the Christian tradition, even if they didn't realize that it did.
Right.
But there's the whole thing going around online where people are accusing, you know, the one guy had visions of an archangel named Metatron and visions of an entity known as the Green Q-Tub. And let me just say, like, and again, I'll say more about this like in our episode when it comes out. But I mean, we have document of him literally saying that I never had those experiences, and those were rumors created to discredit my work. Hmm. So when Christians participate in that particular one, the Metatron thing, we are spreading rumors. We are participating in the continued defamation of somebody that's just not true. Yep. So there's that piece. Then there's also the question of like, should we participate in something if, you know, if it came out of these people that did not practice our faith? And, you know, that's where I'm like, you know, I live in America and a lot of our founding fathers were Christians, but a lot of them were absolutely not Christians and they had a lot of whacked out religious ideas, but I still right. benefit from the work that they brought into the creation of this country on a right. daily basis. So like, the Bible is sufficient for all matters of godliness and wisdom, but the Bible does not tell me how the engine in my car runs. Those are not the same yes. questions. So while the Bible is the ultimate source of wisdom and truth, it's not the only source of information that we can participate in. You know, the Bible can't tell me how, you know, MRI scans work. And so all that to say is that I really encourage folks, you know, to engage with it, you know, but Trevor, to your point, yes, there is sort of this hostility, a skepticism that people have. And a lot of people, I'll be candid. A lot of people that have personally and privately reached out to me in support of the book have not said so on their social media because they don't want to deal with all the people that are going to blow up their comments section because they got other things to deal with. And
I'm a 7-wing-8. I'm happy to do it.
We want all the smoke. We want all the smoke here.
But like, so, and that's something this is related but different. I would love for you specifically to talk to our listeners who are in that position. Like Trevor said, I've had conversations. Trevor and I have both had conversations with people who have kind of been like, no, like when I found this out, my marriage got better. I learned how to talk to my parents better. And I know it's like, be careful. You don't want to like super type other people, but just like knowing ourselves, how like different areas of our life can do better.
Yeah.
But then there's all this.
Like I was able to repent in ways that like definitely changed my marriage.
Yeah. So listeners who have had that experience but then have to deal with the manufactured hostility or the in love, foolish accepting of all these buzzwords from all these other people who are saying this is evil, this is that. Like, what's your encouragement? Like, what would you say to folks who are like, I found value in this, but it's kind of challenging right now? Like,
yeah, I always start here. I always say, you know, listen, I think it's really good that people are asking hard questions. I do not think that Christians, we should just be consuming everything without discretion. I think that that's a foolishness that the Lord does not call us to. So I would encourage you, start by affirming the fact that people are asking questions. It's good. It is good that people are asking it.
Absolutely.
That being said, I think that we have to take the concerns one thing at a time. So if it's a concern about Metatron or the green Q-tub, like let's deal with that. If it's a concern about, you know, Naranjo's comment about automatic writing, let's talk about, well, what does he mean by, because I don't know if you guys have heard that one. That's a whole other one too. But
but like we went deep on it once.
No, it rings a vague, but like in 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were all picking up new hobbies, like I did a lot of reading, but I definitely don't have all the things.
So he's asked, where did the Enneagram come from? And Naranjo says that it comes through automatic writing, and Christians insert our notion of what that means. And in our world, in some people's world, I guess especially more charismatic, like it carries a notion of possession. Mm-hmm. But multiple of his students have come through. In fact, even on the actual YouTube video where he says it, if you go into the comments, one of his most well-known students says all he meant by that was that he has studied psychological theory for so long that when he finally sat down to write, all of his knowledge just kind of flowed easily. But Christians sort of insert this idea of divination or Ouija boards or whatever. And so
people get like weirdly fixated. Part of the deconstruction and reconstruction journey from like having a default oppositional faith and a looking for demons under every rock kind of faith to like maybe one that's a little bit more Christ-like.
Yeah. Yeah. So all that to say is this. I think that we start by saying, listen, I think it's good that you're trying to use discretion. What are your specific concerns? And they usually have to do with worry about the occult. Then it's worry about, well, people are making their identity into their Enneagram type. And I think that those are legit questions, but it's sort of like, I don't know, man, don't blame the Enneagram because somebody's like applying it in an incorrect way. Like if I did that, I mean, good grief, what's more abused than the Bible? And so, I don't think that logic is very sound. And then ultimately also concerns about like, is it psychologically valid? And again, like this guy, you know, one of the main guys that built the thing, I mean, he studied at Harvard, he studied at Berkeley, he's pulling in work from
these liberal places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I kind of get like people's concern. And so let me kind of land the plane here. It's just a tool.
Yeah.
It's just a tool in the same way that we have lots of other things, and it becomes a way that it's a means by which we organize information. We say there's this, there's this, there's this, there's this, put it together. And then here's a word we're going to use just to describe this. so that we can sort of organize that information in ways that are helpful. So,
duh.
So that's all this is. It's a tool to help people begin to work on self-clarity and self-awareness, because relational dysfunction and lack of self-awareness has done horrible things to the church. And that's one of the areas that we all need to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's huge. And that's been a hard one too for the church. I mean, even just empathy, right? We were debating recently over whether that was even a sin. And
yeah, that's
churches were.
Yeah, well, and that's ridiculous too, you know, like, because here's what happens. Here's what they're responding to. Like this whole, like, you know, because one of the big themes in this book is this idea of how does Jesus empathize with all of us? And it's a key part of my book. And one of my concerns is exactly that, is that people have said, well, empathy doesn't have a place. Well, that's, they're responding to this notion of people that only do empathy and they never move on to truth.
Right. Empathy and authority, you say, like in the book, is so key.
Yeah.
He doesn't just relate to us, but he has authority to call us into holiness, call us to repentance.
It's a both. It's a both and. But if it's only authority, we will not experience love. And if it's only empathy, we might feel emotionally like there's love, but there is no solution to our problems. And so, so we need both those things. So yeah. I'm not super into the whole anti-empathy thing. I think that's pretty counter scriptural.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. That is a good way to put it. And you know, for folks who also wanted to learn more about some of these things that you're just talking about, like we did a couple episodes on this. It's been a while. Episode 18, we did on the Enneagram. We talked about the automatic writing, some of that stuff, and linked a whole bunch of resources. It was the episode right after we had Jesse on.
So that was our reflex, guys.
Yeah. And then we also, I think there's another concept here. We talked about the idea of Christian worldview analysis on episode 29. And just like this whole way that like Christians approach things, and it's like, is it biblical? Like we need to like fit it into this grid. And it's like, not all things work that way. Like it's not everything is trying to, you know, if it's just something that's true and out there, like you said,
exactly
like,
what you said about the mechanic deal.
Yeah, like, the mechanic show, like it's not like in competition with the Bible necessarily. And so people, there's more nuanced ways to think through those things. So I think that's really good. But I think one thing that really stands out about this book, and like if somebody actually gives it a second to read it, is that really the center of it is the person of Jesus. And that really comes through. And as I was reading it, like I was learning things about Christ and like thinking about Christ in new ways. I was reading my section in Type 9 and talking about how like Christ experienced what it was like to be unheard, to have his voice kind of shut out, to deal with all these things that I'm afraid of, or I feel guilty about, or things like that. And, but in the end, he was able to exert his energy on the things that mattered most. And how like he was an outsider in his day. Like he felt what it felt like to have something important to say, and then none of the people who had any status in his day actually like care at all, or, you know, align with it. And so I learned things about Jesus in the Gospels, even just reading that work, like in how he can relate to me. And I was wondering, like, as you were writing the book, what are some of the ways that you came to see and love Jesus in new ways that you hadn't seen before?
Yeah. It was a really kind of sweet experience to have to sit and really contemplate and think through in what ways, you know, for each of the nine types, has a core wound, core fear. Each one of those nine are different. And to sit and really consider, so if scripture talks about this idea that like we have a high priest, you know, who understands our sufferings, then like what does that look like for all nine types? And it was a really kind of profound experience. And to come across this idea, you know, I don't even remember if this made it in the book. So maybe it's in there, maybe it's not. But I came across some theologian that referred to this idea of the fellowship of suffering. And this idea that, you know, when scripture talks about, like, when we suffer, we partake in the sufferings of Christ. And when Christ suffers, that there's a sense in which he also partakes in our suffering. And this idea almost of, like, if anyone's ever gone through, like, losing a loved one and the way that it just can rock a community, but that community sort of comes together in a way that's very unique to them. And I think really stopping and thinking about, good grief, what an incredible thing that when I suffer and when I grieve and when I go through hardship and when I put my head on the pillow and I actually stop running from the thing that I'm scared of, and I, you know, that Jesus meets me in that moment and in that place, and not in sort of a theoretical way, he actually gets the pain that I'm experiencing firsthand. That was a really profound moment to realize, like, yeah, that Jesus is with me in the midst of my deepest pain, and that he's not only with me, but even, like, you know, somebody else when they're really suffering and I can't kind of get my brain around it, Jesus can. Like, he's there with them. So I think there was something very, for somebody that grew up in an environment that was very discipleship oriented, and rightly so, I'm not trying to knock that, but, like, very much geared towards we need to obey. It was a very healing experience for me to then sit there and to really think about, okay, yes, I do need to obey, but what does it mean for Jesus to actually step into my suffering with me?
Man, that's good.
In that concept, it can kind of heal some of the wounds that, like, nature and nurture have kind of inflicted on us, personal upbringing and even, like, religious upbringing, and then how it can, if done with love and empathy, heal real relationships. We talk a lot about community and, like, place and where we are, and I love right at the beginning you talked about how we are created for community and how the knowledge of self and, like, living truly, like, both gives us intimacy with God and others. And I mean, that's what we're all made for. That's what we all want and need. So I mean, not that you need to become an Enneagram expert, but I just think of all the people who are feeling alienated or lonely or things like that, and just how helpful these things might be. Like, what would be your encouragement to folks who are maybe kind of feeling a little alienated like that? Like, how can the Enneagram be helpful for them in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of us, part of just the human experience is that all of us at different moments do. We feel lonely. We feel disconnected. We feel misunderstood. And I think that especially happens when we fail to recognize that other people are different than we are, and we are different than other people are. And there's some things that we hold similarities, and there's other things in which we are radically different. And that, you know, neither of the two of you see this world the same way that I do. I don't see it the same way that you do. But there's other areas in which there's some overlap. But I think, like, folks that are feeling that sense of otherness or alienation or misunderstood, I think the Enneagram gives us that tool to go, like, oh, wait, there are other people out there that actually do see the world a little bit like I do. And all the people that are around me right now, a lot of them don't see it the way I do. And that's not a right or a wrong thing, but it gives me language to begin to say, hold on, your starting point is just different than mine. You know, I'm a type 3 with a 4 wing. My wife is a type 6 with a 7 wing. We see the world pretty different instinctually. I see the world as this world sort of a possibility, and that we can overcome and we can build and we can generate and we can frame things in inspiring ways. And my wife tends to see the world in very practical. It's like very, like, worst kind of, like, what are the things we need to plan for and have contingency plans for and make sure that everything's in its place. And if I don't understand the differences there, we will end up punishing each other for the fact that we see it different, versus the Enneagram allows us to go, hold on, we just kind of come at the world from a different lens. And there's ways for me right now to appreciate, oh gosh, I could actually mature right now if I would learn to see it a little bit more like she does, and vice versa. So I think it allows us to empathize with each other more and not punish each other for, you know, not being twins.
That's good. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned some types there, the six and the three. And I wonder your thoughts, because I think some folks struggle with like, oh, like, is it putting me in a box? Or like, you know, do my types change over time? And, you know, we can get technical with, you know, people get technical in the Enneagram. Oh, well, technically this and that. But like, does any of that really matter? If I read this chapter and, you know, I learned this thing about the virtue of exertion from the nine, it was transformative to me. And then I, you know, do maybe some more self-reflection later and find out that I am not a nine or whatever. Like, what's the importance of that? What's the value or not the value of that, I guess?
Yeah. So think of it this way. I remember years ago, Donald Miller described, somebody said, like, what's the simplest way to describe a story? And he said, a story is a character who wants something and has to overcome obstacles to get it. Like, at its most fundamental, that's a story. And I think that the reason that it's important that we do over time try to find the correct type for who we are is, each of us wants something deeply in life. And if we don't if we fail to recognize what that desire is, it will drive us subconsciously. It'll push us forward. It'll make us do things that we will regret. And the whole time, we won't have any sense of why we're doing the things we're doing or our ownership of those things. So example would be this. So for a good decade, I identified as a type four. The key desire of the four is to be authentic, and their deadly sin that they struggle with is envy. Here's the deal. The further I got in, the more years that passed, the reality is I'm like, you know, I got to be honest. I really value authenticity, but I don't know if it's the key thing that drives me as a person. And yeah, I can struggle with envy at moments, but I don't know that it's the one that really kind of tends to cripple me. And that's when I really started to wrestle more with the concept of, I think I might be more of a core three. Core threes, threes want to be valuable. And if I had to choose between authenticity and value, I'm going to go for value. And their deadly sin is deceit, but especially self-deceit. The tendency to get confused between the role they're playing and who they actually are.
Mm. Mm.
And I got to be honest, that is a much bigger issue in my life than envy is. So I think that the importance of identifying the right type is, it shows us what we need to work on and what we need to give to the Lord and what we need to ask him for help with, and an understanding how it's at play in our relationships.
Yeah. In the decade that you spent thinking through things as a four, you think about like the journey the Lord had you on at that time. Like, was that something that you needed to go through in a way to get to where you're at now in God's path of sanctification and like peeling back the layers and growing you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it was definitely like, you know, it's not like a lost decade or anything. You know, I think that, I still continue to have a lot of four quality in my personality. And I think that, you know, all those years of sort of really trying to work on, you know, like, you know, it's not like envy never comes up in my heart, but because it does, I was able to spend time working on, okay, whenever envy comes up, I really want to practice gratitude and being thankful for that. And really learning how to give language to my emotional world, really kind of leaning into my creative gifts, which I do have, making peace with sort of being a cultural outsider at times, which does happen. So I think that there are realities that I was able to kind of, you know, sift through. But I do think ultimately the deeper work that I needed to do, the next layer, I do think that had I just sort of stayed like, oh, I'm just a four, I think it would have been a kind of a convenient way for me to avoid some of these bigger issues I do need to deal with in life.
Yeah. But it's not like, oh, there's some flaw in the Enneagram or I went down some wrong path that like really had me focusing on the things that aren't really issues for me. Like, still, there's things being revealed about your soul and ways that you need to repent and ways that you need to lean into virtue, right?
Yeah. 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 Cause I also think there's this, I mean, there is, you know, the problem for all of us is not our, what type we are. The problem for all of us is it's about healthy versus unhealthy. It's about living out of our true self in Christ or our false self apart from Christ. That is fundamentally the issue. So, I am an equal opportunist. I've got plenty of non-resourceful, unhealthy things pulling from all nine types.
Sure, right?
But I do think at the end of the day, I use the analogy of, you know, if you imagine all nine types as sled dogs, eventually one of those dogs is the lead dog and the other eight are following its lead. And if you don't understand which dog is pulling the rest of them behind it, you know, you're going to have a hard time addressing key issues in life.
Well, and I love analogy. How, again, to the folks who may be nervous or concerned or whatever, and Trevor's already talked about it, I love how the book is so gospel focused and like not just about knowing ourself for the purpose of like self betterment, but like to like really truly to truly become or as best as we can in this life, like the people God create us. And spiritually we go, oh, that's Jesus. I loved at the end of each chapter you're like, no, Jesus was the epitome of the best things of all of these things. You're like, Jesus was the best protector, the best peacemaker, the best achiever, all these things. And whatever we identify with as most, we can look to Jesus for our path forward. It's not just psychology or this archaic system, this scientific like personality test. Like, I thought that was fantastic. That was very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, listen, here's the deal. If you go online, you look at just like traditional Enneagram teaching, which I have benefited from. I'm not trying to knock other Enneagram teachers, but as a Christian, my conviction is we are not transformed by being very, very good people. We are transformed by good news given to us by God. That's, you know, to use Keller's quote, the gospel is not good advice, it's good news. And I think in that same way, the traditional approach to the Enneagram is, oh, you have this vice, you need to practice this virtue to counter that vice. I think that's true, but I do not think that fundamentally in the depth of who we are, that that fully changes us. I think that that's going to require an encounter with the real Jesus.
Yeah.
So one of the structures of the book that is different than traditional Enneagram teaching is, oh, look at all this really, really bad news. And most Enneagram books then just flip over to, okay, now go do these practices. And instead what we do in this book is that we encounter Jesus. And then out of that, then transformation can begin and we can follow him as a disciple.
Yeah.
So if it was like a type seven, so yeah, okay, there's these struggles around this issue of gluttony, and then okay, now there's a calling to sobriety. But for you as a Christian, that needs to come from a place of I practice sobriety as a disciple of Jesus because he has given me this transformative message that he's going to take care of me, that he loves me. Yeah.
Well, and that the best parts of that natural bent, like the joy and the celebration and the curiosity and the valuing of people, Jesus was the model, the ultimate model of that and how to do that in the way that God created us to do that. It's not just like, oh, I'm curious or I'm joyful. It's like Jesus modeled exactly, and as he does for all the types, like the best practices and virtues. And like, that's my way forward. Like you said, not just like a prescription of, oh, like you have an addictive personality or you glut on various things, like do some practices of satisfaction.
We're like actually a new creation in Christ, right? Like it's not that like the old man has passed away, the new man has come. Like that, it's the whole idea. And not just, oh, I'm just going to add some maybe more astute or self-aware behaviors on top of the old man's. Like, no, I've been transformed. I'm a walk in the Spirit, and the Spirit calls me to repent, and he calls me to repent. And so that's going to look particular in certain ways. And like Calvin said, like knowing God and knowing the self, like these things are related. That's a paraphrase. He didn't say it like that.
And then, when you give like tips, like ultimately, like with that spiritual frame there, I need the tips of like build structure into your day much more than Trevor. Like Trevor's naturally structured. Like he's got a spreadsheet brain. Like I don't. I am like chaos.
Like at home, then I want to chill.
But those practices submitted to like the character and the person of God in. Particularly in the God-man Jesus, like that is how, like to live in a disciplined fashion, not just like give yourself a schedule, be disciplined because that's good. It's like, no, like that's how Jesus modeled it. And that's the way to live life. So, I mean, it's simple.
Yeah. I mean, the word discipline is in disciple, right? It's like those two words are from the same root. So like there is definitely a sense of, we are called to transformation and called to change and called to repent and called to stop living this way and live a different way. So yeah, so ultimately, you know, I think that the Enneagram, when utilized with Christian wisdom, offers us a contemporary set of language and lenses to explore some things that maybe are hard for some of us to do.
Yeah.
But again, ultimately, it's going to require that encounter with Jesus. And, you know, you guys have alluded to this a couple of times. One of the things that I mean, the title of the book is How We Relate, and it comes from this idea. It comes from a Richard Rohr quote that then also my friends at Crosspoint Ministry kind of summarized Rohr. But it's this idea of how we relate is how we relate. So my same relational style that I show up with for my wife, for my kids, for my friends, for my coworkers, I bring that exact same style to my relationship with God. And it's why the Bible is always drawing a direct correlation between the way we treat others shows us how we actually treat God. And there's no way to separate those two things. We have one relational style. Yeah. We apply it to all we only have a one way that we know how to be a me. And so,
because that's how I am.
And so again, I think that the gift of the Enneagram is giving us the opportunity to begin to consider what is my relational style and how is it influencing the way that I think about God, see God, respond to God, but the way that I see others, see the world, respond to the world. And it is a naive idea that I see God with clarity and I have a special, totally one relational style with him that I don't apply anywhere else. And then I show up to all my other relationships in a different way. That's just not how we are. We have a one way of being a me. We show up to all our relationships with that style.
So Jesse, this is your book. I'm curious, because of the nature of the Enneagram and different people's access to, like, some people may not know how to figure out what type they are. What do you think the best ways to read this book are? Separate groups, talk with others.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of people that do. They read it by themselves in private, and I think that there's plenty of benefit to doing that. There's no way around it. You're going to get the most use out of it by reading it in a small group, in a small community of people. And again, it just gives you like new language to talk about things. And yeah, I know if you've been around the Enneagram a lot, it can also get annoying. People will overapply it. You know, you'll do something, they'll go, oh, you're just doing that, you know, because you're a nine. And you're just like, hey, why don't you go?
Yeah, you can tell like, the people who just figured it out.
You know, so like there's times where like people are applying it in ways that are a bit obnoxious. But here's what I also find. Let me just, you know, this is a little bit of a detour. But what I have done in more recent years, especially now that for some people, the Enneagram is sort of feels exhausted for, you know, socially for them. I just now talk about all the things about the Enneagram, but I don't ever say the words the Enneagram and I don't ever say a number. And it's because all of that stuff are just, those are shorthand ways of talking about very deep issues. So let's just talk about the deep issues. So if somebody is like, they hate the words Enneagram. I mean, I got plenty of people in my life that love the Lord, but for whatever reason, they're very wary of the Enneagram. Dude, I talk Enneagram with them all the time, but they have no idea I am. And
hilarious.
And so, I encourage folks, go that way. So you can do it solo. You can do it in a group. And then the other thing too, is that if you pick up the book,
give it a five-star review.
But at the end of chapter two, I have two things. Number one is how to discover your type. And then I have a thing called 11 rules for the Enneagram. And so,
yes, I loved this part. I love this.
I like that.
I mean, do you want to just share some of these right here? Is that free?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, even in terms of discovering your type, I always say like focus on motivations, not the behaviors. The reality is that all of us act in very similar ways at times, but we're all doing it for very different reasons. And so it's going to become very important that you understand what is the core motive that drives you. You know, search for who you are and not who you'd prefer to be. A lot of people read the Enneagram and they're like, I'm a blank. And I'm like, I know we're not supposed to type people, but I am positive you are not that. So it is really important that we do the work of being willing to really look at ourselves for who we are. The other thing too is I tell people, pay attention to your embarrassment. You know, you kind of know we're getting into your stuff when you start reading about a type and you just feel uncomfortable. It's a sign you're starting to read some things about yourself and you really wish they weren't true. And somebody's kind of acknowledging that. So those are a couple of tips on how to discover your type. And then also I do say write down all 9 types on a piece of paper. Literally somebody sent me a photo of their daughter doing that this week, wrote down all 9 types. And literally as they read through, they were X-ing out, you know, different numbers as they went through. And then also I established just a few rules as you do work on the Enneagram. And the number one is don't sound like a crazy cult member.
Really important. Yeah,
and nobody wants to hear you sound insane and talk like numbers all the time. You know, if somebody walks in and they hear how you're talking, you sound like you need to, you know, be admitted somewhere. So you don't want to do that. And then also don't weaponize the Enneagram a lot. I mean, really sad, but there are reports of churches, you know, sort of narcissistic leadership in churches getting a hold of the Enneagram. And then now that becomes one more sort of thing they leverage against people. Oh, I can't put you in charge of this because you're this number, or you're just behaving this way because this number. So you don't weaponize it. You really want to treat this with the respect it deserves.
I want to pick up on something you just said there, narcissistic leadership in the church, and something we all admit exists, but I think that it really gets to the heart of some of this, like, why is this helpful, right? Because it's like, at the end of the day, we do all have the Bible, and we have these church leaders who know the Bible and these things, but sometimes just, like, are missing views of themselves that, like, you read the same passage over and over again, and then one day you learn something and it clicks. And why is it that all three of us have found, you know, some value in the Enneagram that unlocks these truths that we were holding in our hands for years all the time?
I mean, I do think on the one hand, I think there's a sense in which we had certain truths, but I think that the Enneagram organizes that information in a way that sort of, our brains are always looking for patterns. We want to categorize things. We want to make sense of chaos. We're not happy that the Legos are just thrown out all over the floor in a massive pile. There's a sense in which our brains want to build something.
Or at least categorize the Legos before we build
something.
Yeah, that's right.
Even. Something. So I think there's a little bit of that. And then, but I will also say this, while there are plenty of, you know, whether it's a church environment, a small group environment, a family environment, a corporate environment, while there are plenty of narcissistic people that do participate with the Enneagram, it has also been my experience that they're very interested in it coming and being taught to others, but they're not very interested when it comes to their own number. And I remember years ago, Dr. Richard Plass told me, there are a few things in life more dangerous than commandeering the language without doing the work. And a lot of bad leadership will do that. Oof. They'll get their hands on either the Bible or the Enneagram or some other tool, and they speak as though they have sort of, they're enlightened, they're informed, they're intelligent, but they're not actually doing any of the personal work themselves. And so in those scenarios, I just have to remind myself, like, the Enneagram is really not the problem. In fact, the Enneagram would be a great asset to that person, but a lot of times for various reasons, they're not capable of doing that work.
Commandeering the language without doing the work. I mean, that is insightful.
And that kind of works in several different areas.
Yeah, it's a good reminder.
Jesse, in my research today, I was looking for some photos of you, and I will check with you and your team if you've had any new headshots or anything for when we're going to promote the episode in the coming weeks. But I found an image that I had forgotten about years ago from HBO.
I was wondering how far you were going to go. When you were...
on Sacha Baron Cohen show, and I was just wondering any memories or takeaways from that interview Enneagram session.
Story? Is that like a life event?
Jesse Eubanks, the noble virgin to now.
I mean, if it gives you anything evidence of like, how do you know you're a three? Well, when the reality TV show calls up and says, "Hey, would you come be on the show?" and you're like, "Well, yeah, I'm gonna get to be on international television, sure."
Some of our listeners who are into physical media may have you on their shelf somewhere.
Yeah. So here's and let me say this too. Just a warning: don't watch the episode. There's like full nudity. Like
it's a rugged episode.
Like 10 minutes
actually,
before
yeah.
I come on, and let me also tell you,
I scrubbed through it.
Let me
also
tell you that when it debuted, I had no notion of what it was going to be. So I invited the entire worship team to come watch it with me.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So did they just say, like, here's your episode? Like, what was this?
So the setup was this. The setup was that the organization, I was a part of this Urban Missions organization at the time. I was living in Philadelphia. They received an email and said, there's a television show from Channel 4 in the UK. They've come to the US. They're filming. They are looking for a young adult who is comfortable speaking about sex and willing to talk about it publicly as it relates to their faith. I had written some articles along those lines. Also,
what a pitch.
You're like, I volunteer.
So wow. I said, heck no. I said, no way. And then my roommates, who always wanted to be on like one of Bill Maurer's shows, were like, you have to go do it. So they like push me. So I go to DC and he walks in and like
as
Ali G, and he's got like his full yellow jumpsuit and his red beanie. Yeah. And I remember,
did you know what it was?
Well, here's what's funny. I'm staring at him and I'm going, man, the UK has really bad fashion right now. Like that was the thought that I kept having. and what I realized later, he was coming in to see did I recognize him. And So I go out and we filmed for, I don't know, man, just shy of 2 hours. And they boiled it down to,
it's been a
very, very short.
Like
and literally the only time I had like an emotional reaction, that is what they used. So like for like 2 hours. And here's the other thing too, is like the first hour, there were zero jokes. It was a straight up legit 100% serious interview.
But then what they air is the wild stuff in your reactions.
They get you
to
tired.
He got weirder and weirder as it went on. And like he made one joke that was so funny and so obscene. I will not repeat it on your podcast, but I laughed so hard in the moment that they couldn't use it because I was trying to and like the other people started answering. I'm like, you cannot. There's no way that he is serious right now. So yeah, man. And here's the thing. I was convinced. I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to be on this talk show in the UK and it's going to be great. And I was touring as a musician. And I remember I was in a hotel in Indianapolis and I turned on the TV and I turned on HBO and this commercial comes on and it leads up and all of a sudden I see him. And I just stared and I just go, oh crap. Like it was like,
you see all of his different characters paraded.
It was, I instantaneously knew like, this is not going to be good. And
you're like, oh, I've been
and
pumped.
it was so much worse than I thought it was going to be. So that's my story. So yeah, if you look me up, I've got Justin Timberlake blonde tips. It's great.
Oh, so good.
Oh, what a story. Holy
so my cow. Wife still refers to me now, even now, as the nobility virgin. So and like so I literally funny. still get social media messages from frat boys all the, like a week ago, a guy starts following me what? And every time I put up a question on Instagram, like some like, hey, what do you think about blank? All his responses have to do with, you know, Ollie G and nobility virgin and like, you know. Yeah, so
that's awesome. So have good. Anybody like ever like have interest in LTN because they found out about you from LEG or something? That would be crazy.
We have higher so standards funny. Than that. So.
The Lord uses lots of things. It'd be amazing.
That's right. That's right. So
good. That is an excellent lead up to our shout outs.
I do not shout out Ollie G. I'm not gonna.
That's one of those rare substance anti-shout outs. Yeah.
Did you see the second Borat movie, which I feel like just came out, but was probably 2 or 3 years ago now at this point?
No, here's the deal. Probably because of my experience, I can't bring myself to watch anything else he's done.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're like,
these innocent people
destroyed lives.
So what have you been reading? What have you been watching? What have you been listening to that you would want to kind of put and feel free to take a few? What's been encouraging you? What have you been finding edifying or refreshing or enjoyable lately?
So, a quick story. So, here's my shout out and just let me set it up just for a moment here. So when I was 19, I graduated high school and I moved out to Oakland, California to be a part of an urban missions program called Mission Year. Mission Year was founded by a guy named Bart Campolo. He's the son of Tony Campolo, who's a famous preacher and teacher. Mm-hmm. That year was very, very transformative for me as a person. But in part, one of the reasons that it was transformative was that when I moved out there, to be honest, I was very uncertain whether I really believed the Bible to be true anymore. I was not sure I was a Christian. So I did what anybody does. I was like, oh, I'll go be a missionary. And so so I get out there. My faith is seriously struggling. And in many ways, Bart ended up giving me sort of a vision for what does an intentional life look like. Mm. But my time there didn't resolve a lot of my theological questions and concerns. So at some point, I come across this book, The Jesus I Never Knew by Philip Yancey. And that book blew my mind. It really sort of, I was just smitten with the Jesus that I discovered in that book. And Yancey really helped me see the Bible in ways that I had not been able to see before. I say all that to say this, this is my recommendation. About 2 weeks ago, Bart Campolo and Philip Yancey had an online dialogue. And the reason that that's fascinating to me is because Bart no longer identifies as a Christian, and Philip Yancey does. They both wrestled with the same questions, the same hardships, the same things that you know are just hard to believe at times. But ultimately, Bart walked away, and Philip Yancey has continued to stay. And I think that dialogue is just a really fascinating one because there's a lot of respect for each other in the midst of that conversation. So so I recommend that.
Would that be YouTube or is that on one of their websites?
Oh, it's just on Philip Yancey's website. Yeah, if you just go to his website, it's on there. The other thing I would recommend that I've been listening to, just in general, I'm just diving into a lot of Philip Yancey stuff. Let me say this, if you're listening to this podcast and you're in a place where you're struggling with doubt, you wish that there were was a context and a place where you could be very open about your doubts and the things that you're having a hard time with and a hard time believing. Philip Yancey's your guy. He's not like an apologetics guy. That's not his thing. His thing is he asks very hard questions and then he spends a lot of time sort of thinking through it and looking to how other people have wrestled with it. He's a journalist. He's narrative. He's a beautiful communicator. He's very gracious. But his books, Reaching for the Invisible God, What's So Amazing About Grace, Disappointment with God, Where is God When It Hurts? His work is just a true gift to Christian faith. And so that's my recommendation. Go do a deep dive into Philip Yancey. If this is your jam, also, he did a two-book series with Dr. Paul Brand, who at the time was the world's leading specialist on leprosy. And the two-part series explored why is pain necessary and what happens actually if we remove all pain from our life, because that's actually what leprosy is. Leprosy is the removal of pain, which ultimately leads to why people end up with disfigured bodies or they lose their eyesight because they don't have any pain receptors. And so very, very fascinating. So anyway, all things Yancey, he's awesome.
Boom. Nice. Love that.
Any obscure music you want to turn us on to? Or you want to keep that off man, yourself?
No. You know, I'm super into sort of like retro, retro Indietronica kind of stuff. And so I'm really into this this band called The Midnight. They're not like Christian or anything. So like let me just warn everybody, I'm not giving you any Christian recommendations right now. So, so I'm super into the Midnight. There's this great band called Sir Sly. I've been listening to a ton of them. My whole family's into this band called Floor, F-L-O-R. We went and saw them in concert not long ago. They were awesome. And then I'm also into this band called Nightly. They're also great. And so, I don't know. There's like, oh my gosh. I'm like looking through my list right now. I could go on forever. There's
literally never heard of any of those. So yeah. That's it's good for us.
Cue up the entire Eubanks playlist right there.
It's amazing. So, yeah, lots of good music out right now.
Love that.
Well, it's great having you back, man.
Yeah. Yes. Glad to be back. It's always good to chat with you guys. And, you know, it's so funny. You know, the first time I came on, we talked about social justice. Now we're talking about the Enneagram. I'm choosing very unpopular topics. I need to really, like, figure out things that are going to, like, go down easier for folks.
No, that's a very nine response to things, though. We gotta speak the truth that needs to be represented.
Yeah, well, that's fine, but I'm tired. So,
No, that's funny.
We can come back when you have your line of essential oils.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, there that's you go. Right. There you go. Those are still popular. I know, I'm really thankful for this work. I think it'll help people see Christ and see how biblical truths relate to them and how they relate to others, how they need to relate to God through this tool. And it really does, I think, in a good way, put the tool in the background and let Christ and his truth and the gospel take the front seat in ways that are really important for everybody, really, but especially for believers to see that and connect to it. So thank you so much for the work, and thank you for your time tonight.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. I love being with you guys and appreciate your all's thoughtful work that you guys are doing. And I hope that this exploration of the Enneagram and Jesus can really be helpful to people.
Awesome.
Excellent. And I'll be sure to put in a 5-star review before this episode.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you. Thank you.
There you go. Same. Listeners, we thank you for joining us today for our conversation with Jesse Eubanks.
So nice to have him back.
So glad that he's a friend of the show and someone who's willing to spend some time with us, take time out of his evening and talk about some stuff. He's just a thoughtful dude and just loves the Lord, and it really comes through in his ministry. It's just such a unique ministry at Love of Thy Neighborhood. Once again, if you haven't checked out that podcast, you should. Just always a great time.
After you've subscribed to Love Thy Neighborhood, checked out their episodes, and checked out this book, give it a 5-star rating and review. Like Trevor said, and like we said in the episode, it is gospel-drenched and Christ-centered, so like, the folks who are against it, I would be very interested to see what they would say to the actual book. So that was our time with Jesse. If you found that valuable and you would like to join us in doing what we do here at The Substance, you can support us at $5 or $10 a month in our anchor link in the show notes. Or if monthly support's not your thing, which I know that's not for everyone, want to throw a couple dollars in our digital tip jar, you can do that on Cash App at $TheSubstancePod.
We love connecting with our listeners, which you can connect with us on thesubstancepod.com. Leave a comment, check out the episode, check out back catalog. Also on all our socials at The Substance Pod. Send us an email at thesubstancepod@gmail.com. Or you can even call us, leave a voicemail at 913-703-3883. And we look forward to hearing from you. It's great having you with us. Without the listeners, we'd just be two guys talking into the ether. Thank you for the time. Once again, my name is Trevor.
And I'm Philip.
We'll see you next time
on The Substance.